Today is the day to wake, work, and win. Welcome to The Standard.
Hey, Rob.
Hey, good morning. Oh. I'm on Montana internet, which some of the wire here got hung apparently in the 1895.
Yeah, so
we have
stuff.
Three centuries of technology going on doing this podcast. So,
where in Montana are you?
Outside of Kalispell.
Really? My dad lives in Big Fork.
Oh, okay. Well, we're actually closer to Big Fork. Yeah, we're out in Many Lakes. So,
Yeah. That's awesome. Do you live out there?
Yep. Yep.
Oh, no kidding. You guys were, I think I heard you were in Reno for a while and then...
We're in Reno for a long time. Thought we'd be there long term, and then did almost 2 years in Texas and liked it, but didn't love it. The kids really like mountains, four seasons, snow, all that stuff. And so when they found out it snows once every 30 years in Texas, they're like, yeah, it's not going to work. So
totally. And it's, yeah. What was that? Ice storm. Were you guys part of the ice storm?
We were selling our house during the snowpocalypse. Yeah, it was, on top of COVID and everything else. And I was just working like crazy to make sure that our pool didn't freeze during that, because it got down to 7 degrees and stayed there for 4 or 5 days. And it was, nothing is built for sub 10 degree weather in Texas. It was ridiculous. Yeah.
I'm sure that really helped your resale value, as you're trying to get people to buy your house in Texas.
Oh, dude, it was, fortunately the folks that were coming in were even more desperate to get in than we were to get out. So it ended up working out. But had our pool frozen, it would have been probably $50,000 of damage to the pool and the pumps and all the stuff. And so it was interesting, very much first world problems, but it was interesting.
So what did you end up having to do? Did you just recirculate? Do you have to, what do you do to keep a pool from freezing when it's not?
Fortunately, it has an automatic thing where recirculates the stuff, but there were power outages and water outages happening everywhere. Oh, and so I had managed to bank a couple of 100 gallons of water that we could feed into there. And then I grabbed one of the last generators in creation, apparently, and had that as a backup. Fortunately, our electricity never went out there, but we did lose water for a week. So yeah.
Well, I got to say, Montana is we live in Denver, which is still a gorgeous place, but there's something about Montana that still feels very wild.
Yeah.
And maybe it's the people, because they're all, they're really nice folks, but they really enjoy their distance as well.
Which I think is
good. You are hands down the smartest person we've ever had on this on this podcast.
That is a super low bar of it.
By a super, super wide margin. But just to run down some of your accolades: biochemist, best-selling author, the godfather really of paleo and honestly CrossFit. And we have been using your product Element for the last year, and it's absolutely incredible. So we feel super lucky to have you. And I think a lot of this podcast is us having the ability to talk to people and pick their brains for our own personal use, and hopefully that the people around us can get a lot of that information as well. So thank you for that.
Awesome. Yeah, huge honor to be here. Thank you.
So I wanted to kind of start out and ask about Element, actually. We did the Leadville 100 recently, and my gut blew up at mile 30. So Element and soup broth was all I had from 30 to mile 100. So, and now it's a staple in our firehouse. Everybody on our crew has been using it and seen the benefits of it. So I'm just curious to know kind of how that all started for you.
Oh man, it is kind of an interesting genesis story. I by background in training, I had a background in biochemistry and was in a research setting looking at autoimmunity and cancer related research, like the lipid metabolism that goes into both cancer and autoimmunity. And around that time, I was tinkering with my nutrition, and I had been fiddling with a vegan diet, kind of high carb, low fat. You know, everybody tells you it's the best way to eat, and it'll, you know, save your life. You'll live forever. You'll be morally superior, and all, you know, all these great things. But for me, it was a disaster. I ended up developing ulcerative colitis, which is this inflammatory gut issue, which can kill you. And I'm 5'9". I'm 160, 165 pounds. At the low ebb of my ulcerative colitis, I was still 5'9", but I was about 125, 130 pounds. So if you imagine 30 pounds less of me, like, I'm not a big guy. So if you imagine 30 pounds less of me, like, that's kind of the state that I was in. And the options for ulcerative colitis historically have been surgery and or immunosuppressive drugs. And both options kind of suck, like, it dramatically life-altering and doesn't really address the underlying issue. And it's a long, convoluted story how the idea of a paleo diet got on my radar, but I was so sick and so desperate, I gave it a shot. And for me, it saved my life. And that was really the genesis of me getting into this whole CrossFit, paleo, ancestral health space. That was kind of the North Star that I used nutritionally to orient how I work with people. I'm not religious about the topic, but, like, when you're working with people and trying to help them either lose weight, get healthy, or a combination of those, like, you kind of need some flag in the ground that you use as a, you know, a benchmark. And that paleo ancestral health thing was kind of what I use. And that's the way I've eaten for the last 24 years. This was 1998 when I stumbled onto this. And everything's been great, except the activities I've historically done. I'm a brown belt in jiu-jitsu. I used to do more CrossFit type stuff back in the day. And those are very glycogen, glycolytic-based activities. Like, you need some carbohydrate, ideally, to do those things. But because of my gut issues and the autoimmune stuff that I have going on, a low-carb diet really helps with, like, the gut issues, autoimmune problems, cognitive stuff that I have from some of the things that I've been dealing with, like rheumatoid arthritis and stuff like that. But then it doesn't really fuel the activity all that well. And so it was just this, like, tough back and forth with these two things where I'm like, well, I guess I'll just kind of suck athletically so that I don't, you know, have my guts blow up and everything. But I kept poking around and trying to find some way to make the whole process work. And it was kind of a interesting set of circumstances, but I found some folks that were pretty high level in coaching people with ketogenic diets. And it's funny, like, about every 6 months, I would just search ketogenic diet, Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And what was hilarious is that I would find like, the main references that I found were from people reading my work going paleo, which isn't really low carb. It's usually lower carb, but it's not low carb. They're like, oh, I totally love it. My recovery is great and everything. I'm like, that's awesome, but that doesn't help me. I don't actually eat paleo. I eat more like keto, you know? But I found some examples, and it was interesting. It was mainly women, and they were competing at a really high level in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. I don't compete in jiu-jitsu, but I'm just trying to find some example of people succeeding in the space. And these gals were competing at a high level, just crushing it. And when I started talking to the folks that were, you know, coaching these gals and explained what I was up to, they were like, I think you're fine on your, like, macronutrients and everything, but you could probably really benefit from adding some more electrolytes to your diet, and especially sodium. And I was kind of like, oh man, I salt my food really thoroughly. I think I'm fine on that. And it took me a good year of still struggling. And eventually these guys were just kind of like, hey, why don't you weigh and measure all your food and keep track of everything you do? And we would like you to be at about 5 grams of sodium per day. And when I did the diligence of actually paying attention to what I was doing, I was consuming fewer than 2 grams of sodium per day.
This episode is brought to you by us. More importantly, our Patreon. And most importantly, our Patreon members. If you like what you're hearing, think about joining us. Head on over to the-standard.us. And for as little as $3 a month, you can get extra episodes, discounts on gear, monthly conference calls. So head on over to our site at the-standard.us. And remember to always like and subscribe. Back to the show.
And when you're on a low-carb diet, your body tends to lose sodium and water at an accelerated rate relative to somebody eating kind of a normal carbohydrate diet. It's called the naturesis of fasting. So they told me, hey, do you like pickle juice? I'm like, yeah, I love pickle juice. They're like, okay, well, the next time you work out, take about 6 to 8 ounces of pickle juice and just shoot that down and report back how you feel. And it was crazy. Like, I, for the first time in like 15 years, I had a pump while working out. I couldn't believe it. Like, I was actually vascular and had that kind of pump that you feel from lifting. And then I did the same thing at jujitsu and I felt great. It was like that low gear was back and my recovery was better. My sleep was better. My HRV score improved immediately. I was like, oh my God, we need to tell everybody about this. And they're like, yeah, we've been trying to do that, you know? And so we spun up this guide that was basically how to make your own keto homebrew electrolyte mix. And it was like this much sodium chloride, this much potassium chloride, magnesium citrate, lemon juice, stevia, water, shake it up and go. And we were super unsophisticated with this thing. Like, we didn't use it as a lead magnet. It wasn't like collecting emails. It was just like, hey, we want to help people. And within 6 months, we had 500,000 downloads of this thing. Like, it was crazy. Like, it just went like wildfire. And people were tagging us on social media and they're like, hey, thank you so much for doing this. This helped us so much. My only complaint is when I travel, TSA doesn't like my 3 bags of white powder. Like, could you guys do some sort of a scoop thing or stick pack or what have you? And that was the whole genesis of Element. Like, I was thinking about it. I'm like, does the world really need another electrolyte? Like, really? But I sat down and I had studied all of the kind of electrolyte physiology ages ago. Like, it was 22 years since I had like formally studied this stuff, but I still had a pretty good grasp of it. But I was like, I'm just going to sit down and do a literature review on this, you know, the athletic implications of sodium intake and electrolytes and everything. And what blew me away was that it's still like the American Council of Sports Medicine has a guideline that, and this will depend on how big of an individual you know, if you're a 5'2" female versus a 6'4" male, like there's already going to be a difference in need because of size and everything. But high activity, high heat, high humidity, the starting place usually for people is 7 to 10 grams of sodium per day.
So
it's like 4 or 5 times more than what the medical recommendations are, you know? And I was like, holy smokes. And then I started looking at all the products that were out there and they've got like 100 milligrams of sodium. And I'm like, you're going to have to drink 100 of these to get. And so what was weird is I was kind of rediscovering how critical this electrolyte story was, particularly sodium. And then the sense that I had was that people, although they knew that electrolytes were important, by and large, the fear of sodium as it relates to hypertension and high blood pressure was causing both manufacturers and consumers to steer away from adequate levels of sodium. So I saw this like crazy opportunity there to, you know, get a properly fueled electrolyte product. And part of what we did is we looked at the meal plans of about 200 people. And they had been logging all their stuff in chronometer and it'd tell you their protein, carbs, fat, but it would also show like sodium, potassium, magnesium, calcium. And what we found is that these folks that were eating a minimally processed whole food, low carb diet, they were fine on calcium, a little deficient in magnesium, more deficient in potassium, but then the sodium was just like woefully deficient. Like it was shockingly deficient. And that's kind of how you see the formulation within Element. It's a gram of sodium, so 1,000 milligrams of sodium, 200 milligrams of potassium, 60 milligrams of magnesium. And then also on the calcium front, although calcium is an important electrolyte, there's a signal in the scientific literature that suggests that supplementing with calcium increases the rate of cardiovascular events like heart attack and stroke, and clotting factors are precipitated by calcium. So I was nervous about adding that to the product because of that. And then also it seemed like people were generally getting enough calcium through through their diet. And so that was like the longest answer to the shortest question.
No, I love it.
Ever been asked, but that's kind of the genesis story there.
Let's bring it back to, cause we're dumb firemen, but it seems like the things that you said, the high humidity, high heat, I mean, that is our workspace.
Yep.
First of all, what is an electrolyte? And I know, like, obviously, you know, I've been drinking Gatorades and we know that it's important, but why? Like, what is it doing for us? And, you know, and then I want to get into kind of the thesis behind, hey, salt's bad for you. Let's, you know, I think it's like what, 2000 milligrams a day is the recommended dose. Like, why is that? Like, how'd they get to that number? So first, you know, like we're kindergartners, what is an electrolyte? Why is it important?
Yeah. So electrolytes help carry electrical signals through the body. It is one of the things that they do. And if folks remember like their, you know, medical physiology stuff that everybody had to do is like an EMT1 and then, you know, start working their way through. Literally every physiological process in the body is driven by these sodium potassium pumps, you know, so like the Krebs cycle, TCA cycle, the way that we generate energy, it helps regulate fluid balance in the body. So we have more sodium outside of cells and more potassium inside of cells, ideally. And if y'all show up and find somebody who's unconscious, like you usually think blood sugar, pH, and then electrolytes. And that's usually the stuff that gets checked. And it's worth noting, clearly a blood sugar change can make somebody sick and can kill them. But people can operate, it depends how insulin resistant they are, but somebody could be a blood glucose level of like 70 and they could get all the way up into the 300 or 400s even and still be alive. Like it's not gonna kill them. The drop is really what kills them. Like if they're usually kind of diabetic and they're high blood sugar and then they drop, like their brain doesn't handle that very well. But it's orders of magnitude changes that you can deal with on blood sugar and not kill the person. But if pH budges a tiny bit one way or the other, person will be very sick or they'll die. And the same thing with electrolytes. Like the body just works like crazy to keep electrolytes within super tight bounds. And it's mainly because every heart contraction, every nerve impulse, every thought, every muscle contraction is driven by these sodium potassium pumps. And they work under really tight tolerances. So if sodium gets low, and the interesting thing is low sodium is the real danger. Like higher sodium levels, if your kidneys are healthy, the body will deal with that and it'll excrete the sodium. It's not that big of a deal. Low sodium, hyponatremia will kill you. And this is one of the things that has been a bastard over, say, like the last 40 years, maybe 50 years, is we had two things. We had this, which we'll get into. We had this, you know, the sense that sodium is this huge bugaboo because of cardiovascular disease and hypertension. And then out of somewhere in health and fitness, we were told to drink, you know, like 8 6-ounce glasses of water a day as a minimum. And so we generally kind of decrease the consumption of sodium if we're not eating processed foods. Like 85% of the sodium people consume is from processed foods. If people aren't eating processed foods, they tend to eat very, very little sodium, which is one of the ironic dangers of shifting one's diet. And this is true whether it's paleo or vegan or anything. If you just start eating healthier, the amount of sodium you consume plummets. And that can actually be a problem. But if we get out of balance on sodium potassium ratios, nothing works. Like the first signs and symptoms is kind of brain fog, lethargy, fatigue. And then once you get into the situation where you're cramping, like you are really far gone. Like if you start getting toe cramps and, you know, muscle cramps, you're really far gone on that sodium potassium ratio. And you've probably had hours of time where you were not operating at your cognitive, like best, executive functioning, not as good planning, memory, you know, fine motor skills, all those things have been degraded for some period of time because of the imbalance on on the electrolytes and sodium potassium ratios. So they're important for electrical transmission within the body, maintaining fluid balance, maintaining fluid status within the cardiovascular system so that we have the right amount of fluid to make the heart beat efficiently. And maybe this is where we kind of talk a little bit about hypertension. Sodium is a factor in hypertension, high blood pressure. And without a doubt, hypertension is just this terrible process with regards to morbidity and mortality, death and disease. Like, high blood pressure accelerates and may be one of the primary causative factors in cardiovascular disease, like aside from smoking and things like that, increases your stroke risk, increases the likelihood that your kidneys will fail. Like, it's really terrible. And our blood volume is controlled by how much sodium the body retains. But that's the really critical part there, is how much sodium the body retains. It's not just how much sodium you put in, but how much sodium the body says, okay, we're going to keep this much of it. And what's interesting about that is for decades, researchers have taken people who are hypertensive, they have high blood pressure, they put these folks on a low sodium diet, and it doesn't really decrease their blood pressure. It goes down a little bit, but it's a trivial amount. It doesn't really solve the problem. And the reason for that is likely because insulin resistance is the driver of the sodium retention. When we become insulin resistant, we need more and more insulin to handle each meal, each bolus of carbohydrate we eat. And when insulin levels are high, they upregulate another hormone called aldosterone, which is an adrenal hormone that causes us to retain sodium. And so the flip side of this is when people change diets, particularly if they eat kind of a lower carb diet, they'll mention that they're just like peeing like crazy for a couple of days and they lose a bunch of water weight. That water weight is their insulin resistance going away, and they're kind of normalizing back to a level where they're retaining the appropriate amount of water and sodium. But interestingly also, almost any type of dietary change, when you're eating minimally processed foods, you do need to get in and usually supplement your diet with some amount of sodium at some point down the road. And in particular, if you have a high motor activity job like y'all do, or, you know, athletics of various kinds, or just generally heat and humidity.
So I got a question. You know, in an industry that we're in and the stuff we do on a daily basis, it's high intensity. So we're losing a lot of fluid. And I quote Craig on this because he's halfway joking when he says this to the guys at the station, but, you know, rehydration's a big deal. And he'll say, yeah, if that's just water, you might as well just throw it out the window. And he's got a pack of salts in his hand.
Right.
And of course, I give him a hard time. Like, oh, yeah, you just want me to throw this out the window? I mean, come on. There's got to be some benefit to, you know, still hydrating, rehydrating with water. But how much truth is to that? Like, with what you're saying, if we are so depleted, just putting water in our system.
Situationally, it's super true. Because if one is low sodium, if you're hyponatremic, and you throw plain water on top of that, you can kill the person. And this is like every year, new military recruits, fraternity and sorority hazing where they're drinking lots of water, double days at football where these kids will go out and they're going to drink that gallon of water during the double day practice, and then they end up hospitalized due to hyponatremia, and some of them die. And it's a crazy thing, because you literally sound like a crazy person saying this stuff. But in one of my tabs open here, there's this paper, Evolution of Water Conservation in Humans. And it makes this case that for some reason, somehow, relative to other primates, like, humans are more like a camel than we are other primates. Like, we're really designed to function pretty well at running into dehydration relative to a lot of other animals. And it's a really complex topic, and I'm trying to work my way through this and some other papers so I can understand it myself, but help other folks kind of get their arms around this thing. But there is kind of a reality that, depending on the situation, if the individual is hypovolemic, if they're low blood volume and they are hyponatremic, low sodium, throwing just plain water at the person is potentially going to make the situation worse, ironically. And so, you know, this is why, again, when you folks deliver people to the ER, like even prior to that, you've got like normal saline, and something folks don't understand, like a liter container is a little bit larger than this thing. Normal saline is a 9% sodium solution. That means it's got 9 grams of sodium. That's like about six teaspoons of table salt dissolved in that liter of normal saline. And, you know, people in the fire paramedic service hook people up to normal saline all the time. They never bat an eye at that. But then the notion of like oral rehydration therapy with an aggressive amount of sodium, people get
That's
super freaked out about it.
How many times does a liter of fluid solve a hangover or like a,
I mean, I've never been hungover, but I've heard.
Oh yeah. You don't
I've heard
do
it's bad. Well, yeah. The reason I said that, that you might as well throw water out if it doesn't have any salt in it is because I was under the understanding that if you do more than 5 ounces of water every like 10 to 15 minutes, that water just sits in your stomach because it doesn't have what it needs to get into your system. So you end up feeling like, and this is just from, you know, endurance sports when they're like, don't drink too much, 'cause then you'll feel bloated and you'll just have this water just like sitting in your gut. I mean, is there any truth to that?
There's some truth to that. I mean, a trickle is always better than a shotgun with any of this stuff. Water uptake is facilitated with sodium, like the co-transporters that help move water around. Water will also just spontaneously diffuse through those membranes, and then there's some active transport mechanisms that will actively move water around. But this is like if you think about like the fraternity hazing thing where they're having guys like drink lots of water, like you can kill somebody with that. So because it will so dilute the sodium potassium ratio in the body that the nerves quit functioning and the person will stop breathing, their heart will quit functioning, and it's almost so like lethal injection is where they give people a huge bolus of potassium and the heart cramps, and that's it. The hypervolemic, hyponatremic, low sodium situation from over consuming water is kind of the same way, but it's arriving at it from putting so much water in the mix that the body doesn't have enough sodium to kind of balance the sodium potassium ratios. And then our electrical impulses stop working properly.
What are your thoughts on, there was a gentleman, I can't remember his name for the life of me, maybe you've heard, but he was saying that if like prior to some sort of big event, taking in roughly like 4 to 5 grams of sodium about 15 minutes before, which increases your blood volume and it'll basically allow, it's like almost like blood doping where you would have more. What can you talk to me about that?
Yeah. I mean, this is sketchy though. I want to put a little asterisk on this, but when we get into, you know, performance athletics, people do sketchy shit all the time. When we start exercising, the body tends to downregulate a hormone called antidiuretic hormone, and it slows the amount of urine that is produced. And this makes sense. Like if you start exercising, the body's like, oh, we don't want that to go out. We don't literally want to piss our body water away. We want to save that for cooling via evaporative cooling with sweat. And so something that folks will do is to hyperhydrate prior to an event. And if you do it smart, you do it with a proper electrolyte ratio, some sodium, some potassium in it, and you drop that into your system 10, 15 minutes before activity begins. So you start kind of bloating up like a tick, like literally your body is kind of like sticking water and fluid everywhere that it can. And then just as the kidneys would really start ramping up, releasing that stuff, then the exercise begins and it downregulates the antidiuretic hormone. And so you're basically running around with more body water than what you would have had otherwise. And that can improve the hydrodynamics of the heart. Like the heart, part of the efficiency of the heart and the improvement in heart function as we start exercising is when that left ventricle fills, the heart material is stretchy. So you should think about it more like a trampoline. Like in my head, I think about like a trampoline getting distended and then boosting. And so when the heart fills, that preload actually helps to then efficiently eject all of the fluid out of the heart and push it around the body. And an overly filled circulatory system can be dangerous in that regard. But in this exercise context, there's a little bit of a hack there. The hazards with this are that some people can get some adverse events cardiovascularly doing this. Like they can stroke out and have some other like not great things happen. And then another and probably more likely challenge, but less threatening challenge, is if you get that big bolus of electrolyte rich fluid in your system really fast, can give you disaster pants. And I don't know too many people that win too many world championships when they're just, you know, shitting their brains out during the process. So that is another major concern on this. But this is where, if people wanted to play with this, and there are protocols out in the interwebs to look at, like people have kind of mapped this stuff out and figured it out. I would just, if you play with this, clearly, you know, get a clean bill of health and all that type of jive beforehand, but map it out in your practice time. Don't like show up at your important game day and you're like, oh, I'm just going to give this thing a shot. Like that seems disastrous to me.
When it comes to retention or water retention, and I think a lot of people that we involve ourselves with use a lot of supplements in addition mm-hmm. to everything else, and creatine being one of those things. I mean, how dangerous is that for a job like ours when you take a lot of that maybe in the morning and then we catch a fire? Or, I mean, does that have any negative effects?
No. And I mean, the creatine is interesting. Like I'm not a huge supplement fan broadly, like for the whole population. I think that there's a lot of really cool stuff for very specific situations, but creatine is one of those things that I can't think of anybody that wouldn't benefit from taking it, other than somebody on like stage 4 renal failure dialysis, you know. And particularly for the line of work that y'all are in, traumatic brain injury is a real potentiality because of shit falling on you, because of acceleration, deceleration events, and then hypoxic potentiality, you know, like being in a fire and being exposed to a low oxygen environment. And creatine is really neuroprotective. Like there's some legit science out there that shows that let's say you were knocked unconscious and your air supply was compromised and somebody managed to drag you out, but it was a little longer than what we would like, and you were in a hypoxic environment, that creatine could buy you minutes of preventing abject brain damage or brain death relative to somebody who's not supplemented with creatine. And I'll throw a little side note out there. Ketogenic diet buys you even more time. And I'm not saying everybody in fire service should be on a ketogenic diet, but there's some really fascinating characteristics about low carbon ketogenic diets and some of the performance challenges that police, military, fire, you know, face. DARPA has funded millions of dollars in ketone research over the last 10 years, trying to look at it like extreme environments, like Navy SEALs that go from super high altitude, you know, parachute jumps, mountaineering at high altitudes, to hyper pressurized environments where they're, you know, they have those like one man submersible, you know, submarines that they cruise around in and stuff like that. They're subjected to huge amounts of oxygen toxicity pressure under those environments. And this is where some of those folks have used ketone salts, ketone esters, and or ketogenic diets to help deal with that, because it will, it's weird, but if people are put in a hyper oxygenated environment, it can and will induce seizures. It can also make people just kind of crazy, like the brain stops functioning properly when the oxygen isn't being delivered via the hemoglobin. When the blood is starting to get saturated with the oxygen, there's some kind of wacky things that happen with that. And ketogenic diets can alter the brain metabolism in a favorable way to buy you more time. Like it basically prevents the seizures that would normally happen from a hyper-oxygenated environment. So there's different scenarios where you could think about, maybe I would want to be in a ketogenic state for this thing, and certainly might want to have my electrolytes topped off and or supplement with something like creatine too. It's just one of those, like, creatine is like a commodity now. Like, it probably costs you about 25 cents a scoop to do a 5 gram serving a day or something. And it is cardioprotective, neuroprotective, antioxidant. About 70% of the population sees an improvement in, like, kind of one rep max, you know, 100 meter sprint activity. 25% of the population is a non-responder with regards to the performance side, but they still get the neuroprotective benefits and all that stuff. And it's literally like pennies a day. So creatine is one of those things that I'm like, I can't see why anybody wouldn't take it. And
are there any other supplements? Like, I feel like over this last few years with COVID and everything, it seems like vitamin D and
vitamin D,
like, yep, seems to be, you know, a vitamin C, like, those seem to be, can't really do you much harm. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, vitamin D for sure. And the vitamin D piece is interesting, though. The main benefit seems to be vitamin D derived from sunlight exposure, or getting like a UV lamp. Like, there's an outfit called Spurdy Lamps, which is a vitamin D, you know, UV light lamp. It is different getting vitamin D from ultraviolet light. It creates this cascade in the body in the production of vitamin D, and it, all those intermediates play important metabolic roles. And so I think if you live in a cloudy environment, like, the Kalispell is a beautiful area, but we do get an inversion layer, and like, we only get like 120 days of legit sunshine a year, which I get like kind of difficulty breathing, anxiety even saying that, because I really like the sun. But there does seem like, when the studies have looked at, say, like COVID severity, morbidity, mortality, and vitamin D status, there's a mixed signal there. But what seems to be the case is that the people who are getting the vitamin D primarily from sunlight, their vitamin D levels correlate really well with doing well with, and this is true, like, let's not call it COVID, let's just call it the flu. It's exactly the same story with flu. Like, severity of influenza is dramatically mitigated relative to vitamin D status and just overall, like, metabolic health, like being overweight, obese, those sorts of things dramatically worsen the severity of different infectious disease. I'm trying to think of another supplement. Like, again, like, vitamin C is cool. And I think in targeted situations, melatonin is really cool in targeted situations. But when I'm thinking about like a recommendation for everybody, that's tough. That's where it's kind of like electrolytes. I'd like to see people out in the sun more, because I'd like to see them get their vitamin D. And if people are concerned about skin cancer, there's some great research that makes the case that your likelihood of all cancers and all-cause mortality is dramatically reduced with safe, reasonable sun exposure. And there's an app called D-Minder. And what it will do, it'll ask you what your skin type is. Like, do you tan easily? Do you just burn? Like, if you're a ginger and you just, like, you're like a vampire and you see the sun and you start bursting in the flame, that it takes that. It takes your latitude, time of year, and it basically gives you a prescription for how long to be in the sun to maximize vitamin D production and minimize potential skin damage. And since I've been using that the last couple of years, my D levels are higher than they've ever been. And I actually have less of a tan than I historically have had, because I only stay in the sun long enough to maximize that vitamin D. And then I put on a hat, long sleeve shirt, and then kind of minimize my sun exposure that way. So everything in life is a risk reward kind of scenario. But I just couldn't push harder on getting vitamin D from the sun or a UV source, creatine, and electrolytes. And those things are stuff that I'm like, everybody, 99.9% of people would benefit from that. And then from there, it starts getting really specific and granular. It's like, yeah, you might benefit from it, but you would benefit from it under this circumstance. Like, vitamin C, just really quickly, if you take that post-workout, vitamin C is a great antioxidant. But some of the benefit of athletic training, of working out, whether it's resistance training or aerobics, it causes a low level amount of damage to the body and some oxidative stress that the body then adapts to. It's called a hormetic response. We get exposed to a little bit of damage now, the body adapts to it and gets stronger. NSAIDs, vitamin C taken post-training tends to block the lion's share of the adaptive process to athletic training. So, you know, you have to be really targeted in the supplementation around this stuff. Otherwise, you could end up kind of shooting yourself in the foot.
I think COVID's still fresh in our mind, and I like how you compared it. COVID, it's a lot like the flu and that approach. But I'm curious, just on a personal level, how did you navigate those few years, you know, that pandemic? What was successful for you?
Oh, man. Trying to think of how to answer this in a way that we don't get canceled. Like, canceling seems to be going out of vogue a little bit. So one thing is, as just a little bit of background, like, I'm a little bit of a doomsday bunkery type person. Like, I've been waiting since around 2008 for the world to end to some regard, like financial crisis. You know, I've been aware of EMP pulses, either natural from the sun or like a nuclear weapon detonated high atmosphere and destroying our power grid. So I've been kind of like, oh, some shit's going to hit the fan.
Montana's a great place for you.
Kind of a little bit of the reason why we ended up here. I'm a little bit weird and paranoid that way.
No doubt.
But a pandemic has been one of these things, like in the back of my, and I don't put a ton of time into this stuff. I'm not, you know, just waiting for the world to end, but I've taken a little bit of hedged risk mitigating around like, oh, what if this happened? What if that happened? And the idea of a pandemic was one of those things. I'm like, oh yeah, 1918 flu, like it will happen. Those things will happen. They just happen on some sort of a cyclical event. And when this stuff first started spinning up, it's funny, we were down in Costa Rica at a jiu-jitsu camp, and it was, I had been hearing about this, you know, SARS-like event in China, and I had checked out SARS-1 and MERS maybe 10 years before that. And those things are super nasty. They have like a 30% fatality rate, like no joke, like if 100 people get it, 30 of them die, and the 70 that survived are really sick, like really, really sick. It's not a deal where, like, I don't know, maybe I'm sick, maybe I'm not. Like, if you survive, you're still laid out from it. The only thing good about SARS-1 and MERS is the variety that people catch from camels, is that they're really, really hard to catch. But if you had something that was easy to transmit and was super deadly, like that is a pretty gnarly combination. So when this stuff started popping up, like my wife and I had a discussion, like we made sure that our estate planning was in order. Like if I died, this was the plan. If she died, this was the plan. If we both died, this is what would happen with the kids and who they would go to. And if one of the kids died, you know, this was, I took it super serious, but it was around April when the suggestion was that the solution that we had on the horizon was a vaccine. And my hound dog ears just like flipped forward, and I'm like, oh, this is bullshit. Like, this can't be the only, like, I was waiting for like this Manhattan Project of what are all the repurposed drugs that we can use to mitigate the severity of this situation, you know, because this way it was sold to us as like this existential threat. Like, this is potentially going to cripple civilization as we understand it. And so I'm like, okay, like we're going to have a Manhattan Project type thing here when they developed the atomic bomb. And they had these teams working in different areas. Some people thought a uranium bomb was going to work, and some people thought a plutonium bomb was going to work, and nobody knew if it was going to work. And we were actually fighting real Nazis at the time trying to do the same thing. And so we had to win this gig, and none of that happened. Like, what I started seeing was that any talk around like ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine or any of these other methods were getting censored online. And then there was this thing that there was going to be a vaccine with a novel technology in a class of viruses that had never seen a successful vaccine ever. Like HIV, they've been trying to do a vaccine since the 80s, and we still don't have a viable HIV vaccine. And so when I heard that was our Obi-Wan, that was our only hope, I immediately, this is coming from somebody who's like, oh, this is going to fuck us up. Like, this is going to be a huge deal. A bunch of people are going to die. I went from being that person to there is something seriously not consistent here. But unfortunately, we were in Texas for the first part of the whole Shindig, and then we've been in Montana now for, I guess, about 18 months. So, you know, we kind of straddled the two of those with that. But I just made sure that I kept my metabolic health good, like not being overweight, trying to keep my vitamin D levels on point. We continued to do jujitsu during these times. If I felt off, then I didn't go to jujitsu. If somebody at jujitsu wasn't feeling well, they didn't come. You know, people just did reasonable stuff, but my fear of that situation just plummeted because I really looked closely at the information that was available, and like the median age of death was nearly 80 years old. Like half of the people that died were 80 years old or older. And it's shitty to say, but once you're that old, like your likelihood of dying from anything is like 20,000 times greater than dying from any given thing when you're 20 years old. Like when you get older, like it's just the likelihood of dying from anything, like sneezing is practically going to kill you at that point. And they started looking at that stuff and started looking at, you know, virtually nobody without metabolic disease was dying from this. Virtually nobody without metabolic disease, insulin resistance, cardiovascular disease, kidney disease. They weren't even getting particularly sick. Like I you know, and the two people that I knew personally who died from COVID, they were classmates, and it's very unfortunate. One was 55 pounds overweight, a pack a day smoker since she was 13. And she was a great person, hilarious person, but like every social media picture she had this giant tankard of cocktail that she was always drinking, and it didn't really matter what time of day it was. And it was kind of a joke. It's like, oh yeah, man, like she's kind of half three sheets to the wind, like any given time of the day or night. And then beyond that, I didn't know anybody in my peer group who was even particularly negatively affected, except one person who was healthy, was lean. And and this guy got really sick and had a hell of a time getting back to good health. And his sleep sucked. And his sleep has always sucked. He's a kind of a entrepreneur CEO type, and would go to bed at 3 a.m. and then wake up at kind of odd hours. And I think that is because you guys know, like this is one of the challenges being in any of the first responder stuff, like that disordered sleep just crushes people.
Yeah. I mean, that dovetails nicely. And what we really wanted to talk about too with you is sleep deprivation. I mean, I'm beginning to, I mean, it's number one priority on my, I guess, health journey. Everybody's got a health journey, you know, like, you know, there's strength, there's fitness, there's cardio. Sleep is number one right now but partly because my sleep is shitty, you know,
right.
5 to 6 hours is a good thing, and it's broken up, and it's just the habits from our job. And I think a majority of firefighters feel that, you know, anybody who's working night shift, stuff like that. It's just any nutritional advice that can help with that? I mean, you mentioned melatonin, right? I mean,
so we did I'm on the board of directors of a medical clinic in Reno that did, backing up a little bit, in 2003, there were three UNLV police officers that went down to either a stroke or a heart attack. Like two of them had strokes or two of them had heart attacks, and one had vice versa. But all of them survived, which is good, but all of them then are medically retired because it's assumed that that disease process is a consequence of the work that they do, which is almost certainly the case because of hypervigilant state and sleep deprivation and everything. And so folks started asking, hey, could we screen these first responders and find the people that are at high risk for these issues and then get out in front of that? And it took a number of years for this clinic that I became part of in 2009 to really get a good algorithm for finding folks. And we use some advanced kind of blood work testing. It's really inexpensive. It's like $100-$150, but very, very few people use it. But between that and a really thorough medical history, we can figure out what a person's risk profile is, basically of their metabolic health. And we did a pilot study where we found 38 police and firefighters in the Reno system that were at high risk for type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease. and we got these folks on a lower carb diet, which I would make the case that if you're in that shift work scenario, one of the primary features of shift work is that you become insulin resistant, period. Like this is crystal clear in the literature.
What does that mean?
And
what does insulin resistant mean?
When we're insulin sensitive, we can handle carbohydrate pretty well and we're metabolically healthy. And when we're insulin resistant, our blood pressure tends to go up. Our blood glucose levels tend to go up. The insulin resistance at some point becomes type 2 diabetes. Like it's kind of an arbitrary definition, but most of the population that we see, and particularly people who are shift work, like they're deep into that pre-diabetic spectrum. Like they're, my wife and I, we did an experiment for my second book, Wired to Eat, where I ate 50 grams of carbohydrate from white rice, basically a cup, and she ate 50 grams of carbohydrate. My wife is super metabolically healthy. She's kind of a stud athlete. Her blood sugar hit like about 115, 120 at the high and then was back down to a normal and she didn't notice anything. My blood sugar hit like 190 and I felt like absolute garbage. And I'm lean. It looks like I'm healthy, but I've got some gut issues. I have some metabolic issues where I just don't handle carbohydrate all that well. And so the shift work individual and what we see in police and firework is people come in young, they come in healthy, and then they just get ground down to a nub over time. You know, they're 10 years in and the wheels start kind of falling off the wagon 20 years in, and there's usually a lot of challenges. But that lever of eating a lower carb diet, and it doesn't have to be ketogenic, but like just minimizing the junk carbs is a massive tool in that, because these individuals just don't respond favorably to carbohydrate. And when blood sugar levels get really high, it damages the heart, it damages the brain, it damages the eyes. Like it's just bad news all the way around. All of the diabetic complications that you all see when you do your calls, this is what's happening. And it's like, it's just eroding your capacity to recover over time. So a lower carb diet is a great way to mitigate that. Zone 2 cardio, like that nasal breathing level of cardio, lifting weights a couple of days a week. And then around the sleep period, whenever it is that you get to sleep, pitch dark room, cool, maybe earplugs, maybe like a white noise generator, something like some melatonin to help you, induce that sleep state. A great guy you guys should have on is my good friend, Dr. Kirk Parsley. He's a retired Navy SEAL and he's a physician. He ran all of the dive medicine concerns for the West Coast SEALs for like 8 years, but he's a sleep expert. And this is the guy that I've learned the bulk of my understanding around the sleep stuff. But he has a product called Sleep Remedy that it's got all the constituents that help to initiate sleep and also maintain sleep, because the sleep initiation is driven by melatonin and then the maintenance is maintained by GABA. And this is where like alcohol, unfortunately, really sucks with regards to sleep, because it will make you unconscious, but it interrupts normal sleep architecture. So the really restorative elements of sleep are really dramatically impaired because alcohol kind of antagonizes that GABAergic part of the brain and the whole sleep process that's facilitated by GABA. So
isn't melatonin a hormone?
It's a neurotransmitter, a hormone. Yeah. I mean, we produce a ton of it in the gut, a lot of it in the brain. It's active as an antioxidant within all of our cells. Yeah.
You start to add that unnaturally, does that mess up your body's ability to do it itself?
There's conflicting thoughts on that. Some people say yes, some people say no. Dr. Parsley is of the opinion that so long as you keep the amount that you're supplementing right around what we would produce physiologically, that it's not that big of a deal. And one of the problems that occurs is when people get in this disordered sleep scenario, you just don't produce the normal amounts of melatonin. Like inflammation interrupts things. And also, like if you're in that flipped schedule where you're awake all night and then theoretically sleeping during the day, it's very difficult to get the body to go down during the day. And this is where I think I've got them around here somewhere, but like red glasses, the blue blockers, when you are winding down for the evening, whatever your evening is, putting on blue blockers, maybe taking some of that melatonin, if you have some alcohol, try to have it as far away from your sleep time as you possibly can. Caffeine is a big deal. And this just slays people. But about 50 milligrams of caffeine every 2 hours is about the optimum to induce alertness and wakefulness. But it varies from person to person how long it takes to clear caffeine out of the system. And so this is, people are going to freak out on this, but like if you need to be alert, but you're heading towards the end of your shift, like something like a nicotine mint, like a milligram, half milligram, the hours before sleep. Interestingly, nicotine will keep you awake and it will keep you more alert, but it will not antagonize sleep. So like if you're early in your shift doing a little bit of caffeine, later in your shift, if you still need to be awake, but you see the light on the horizon that you'll be able to go to bed, like shifting out of caffeine and towards just a really low. And the problem with nicotine historically is that people will smoke it or chew or snuff and stuff like that. And the tobacco is terrible. Like it's
just for clarification,
super potent carcinogen. Yeah.
Just for clarification, you are not telling people to put in 5 Zins at 12 milligrams a piece long, which is what a lot of our crew does.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about all these different levels and how personalized nutrition is for everybody, where can someone go, or is there a place you can go get a blood test and then you get a readout saying, hey, you're actually shouldn't be eating this. You need more of this in your diet. I mean, I know there are some companies like Inside Tracker that's out there. But do you have any recommendations? I mean, we have, as you know, public servants, when we go to the doctor, we have a 5-minute visit. They check our blood pressure and, you know, have a good day.
Right.
What would you suggest someone do if, like, I want to go to someone and figure out what I should be eating, where my blind spots are health-wise?
That's a complex topic.
Oh,
like a first whistle stop is this outfit called Precision Health Reports. And I'm friends with them. I'm not associated with them. I don't make any money from them. You should have some of those guys on the podcast too, Dr. Bill Cromwell. This is the same methodology that we used for the risk assessment program in Reno to figure out what somebody's risk status is for type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease. So Precision Health Reports, you go to any LabCorp, you get your blood drawn, and then what they give you is a 10-year risk profile for having a heart attack, stroke, or type 2 diabetes. And that, I think, is really valuable just to get as a benchmark. Like if you're a young, healthy individual, maybe newer to service, it'd be great to have that as a benchmark so we can see how the person does as they go through their career. But also, if you've got kind of a higher risk profile than what we want, then they don't tell you exactly what to eat, but they're actually pretty big fans of low carb and paleo type diets and stuff like that. And if you are insulin resistant, they'll usually recommend kind of like a carbohydrate cap so that we get some blood sugar control. I really love that, particularly for first responders, because in my opinion, like the most important thing to know is what your metabolic risk profile is today. And again, then we can use that like as a guideline for what we need to do, like lifting some weights, doing some cardio, fighting tooth and nail to get on a more amenable like sleep schedule or whatever. And then the what to do from there, I wouldn't say it's easy, but it's easier, especially if we know what the situation is. And also, again, like people start off in these police, military, fire breathing, monsters in the beginning, and the work grinds them down. And so I think getting that benchmark early, so that what do you look like when you're metabolically healthy and young? And then as you get older, we at least have that to look back to it as a guideline, like, well, we want your blood sugar to look like that. We want your cholesterol to look like this. And this is the stuff that we're going to do to try to get you back to that spot.
Switching gears real quick. I think you have been on the cusp of some of the like biggest,
like a serial entrepreneur.
Yeah. Like you were at the beginning of CrossFit, the beginning of paleo. Element Salts is, in my opinion, and I know that I'm like, I just screaming, one of the most important supplements that you can take for performance.
A few startups too, right? I mean,
yeah.
Yeah.
what are you excited about now? Like, what is that kind of next thing that you're as excited about as those other things?
Yeah. You know, like over my shoulder, there's this sacred cow poster. I think we got it there. I wrote a book on that, and there's a lot of discussion out in the interwebs and in the world about climate change and some of the concerns around that. And one of the primary things that is held up as the driver of all these, you know, dangers are grazing animals, are cows. And it is, I hate saying it like this because it's a complex topic. And when you put these emphatic one-line statements, like I think it convinces some people and hopefully actually unsells other people, but it's kind of ridiculous. Like when you really dig into this, like if we're really legitimately concerned about climate change, and we probably should be, but if you're blaming cows as the primary driver of climate change, you were barking up the wrong goddamn tree. And so this is the thing that I've been really fired up about. And this gets out into kind of political stuff, but from like a World Economic Forum level on down, there's been this big push to get people to eat less meat, to have more of our food produced in this kind of food as IP, food as intellectual property thing, like these genetically modified, you know, grains and fake meats like Impossible Burger and Beyond Meat and all this stuff.
It makes you bite people's noses off.
Yeah, and people will bite their noses off apparently when they eat that stuff. Yeah, their COO went crazy at a Oklahoma football game or something and bit a dude's nose, the tip of his nose off. But I'm pretty fired up about that because it the energy, like oil, nuclear energy, all that stuff is really, really important. Like we're looking over in Europe right now and like they're going to have a hell of a winter because of some decisions made around green energy and climate change and all that stuff. And I think it's really, really short-sighted. And there's also a lot of weird stuff going on with food. Like Sri Lanka was one of the fastest growing economies in the developing world. And a year and a half ago, they just on a dime, they said, we're going to go 100% organic and we're not going to use like synthetic chemical fertilizers and all this other stuff. They're in like a dire food crisis now, and energy crisis, food crisis, riots, people dying. And they went from one of the poorest countries in the world to being one of the fastest growing, like wealth, like people moving from abject poverty to middle class and wealthy. It was happening faster than like we've ever seen in virtually any country ever. Now it is completely reversing. And we're looking at Europe and food security, like the Netherlands has been tasked to dispatch like one third of all of its grazing animals. Ireland has been told that a bunch of their farmers need to be bought out and the meat production shuttered because of like climate change issues and stuff like that. So I'm super fired up about that because I think that like if you want to control a populace, if you control energy and control food, you control the populace. And I think there are well-intentioned people in that space who are unfortunately completely ignorant of economics, thermodynamics, and evolutionary biology. And so they have no goddamn idea what they're doing with this stuff, but it sounds really good. It makes you feel good. It makes you feel like you're part of, you know, some bigger movement and team and all that. And I appreciate that, but it's also like terrible advice. And what? I think that it's going to horribly backfire. And so I'm fighting pretty hard to just get people to ask better questions. Like, it is the idea that grazing animals are the primary driver of climate change. Does that really hold water? Like, is that really the place that we should be looking for addressing things? And if that's not the primary driver of climate change, why is it being hung that it is? And why are we not looking at the other areas that are maybe more concerning? And, well,
I think you hit on it is that, you know, that's an easy, hey, this is the problem, let's just go attack this side. But I think one thing that COVID taught us was the people we turn into when someone starts fucking with our food. When you can't go to the grocery store and get whatever you want, that feeling you get, our civility is pretty fragile.
Right?
Yeah.
And well, there's a saying, we're three meals away from chaos and revolt.
I don't think
we are.
I don't think that's too far off.
Yeah.
And Yeah, I loved your, if anyone who hasn't listened to it, the lady you wrote the book with, I'm so sorry, I forgot.
Diana Rogers, yeah.
Yeah, your guys' Rogan podcast was absolutely fantastic. Yeah. So anyone who has not listened to that absolutely should. Yeah, and I think you see it maybe living in Montana where they have a much different view on being a little bit more self-sustaining and how mm-hmm. important that is. I mean, I know I feel it inside our group here, but a majority of the population just does not have a grasp on that.
Yeah, and it's a lot to unpack, and it's weird. It's like almost saying less is better than saying more, but all that I'm advocating for is that there are more farmers, more ranches, smaller food operations. More of our food should be eaten locally versus shipped here, there, and everywhere. Yeah. It is the crazy thing that I'm suggesting. I think that creates a lot more economic infrastructure at the local level, and it creates a lot more food security, both locally and at, you know, larger scales. If we are completely dependent on like two or three different varieties of row crops and this stuff getting processed in like centralized facilities and then redistributed, if one little thing happens at any one of those choke points, the population is really in peril at that point. So the thing that I'm advocating for is smaller and decentralized. Whatever side of the political aisle you're on, it seems like that should make sense. Like I can see somebody left-leaning, somebody right-leaning, really coming to terms with that makes a lot of sense. And Joel Salatin, who's a great guy who's been championing this regenerative ag scene, he was given a talk, and there was a vegan couple there, and they were like, well, you know, you raise a lot of animals, what does that mean for us? We don't really eat meat. And he's like, listen, if you let me feed my family the way that I want to feed my family, I promise you I'll make enough food so that you can feed your family the way that you want to feed your family. And he's very libertarian and market oriented and everything. And that just resonates with me, you know, like let's create a scenario where we all benefit, where the high tide raises all boats. And if you have different views and whatnot, that's great. And I'll honor that, but do me the good of honoring where I'm at, even though it may be different than your views on this stuff. And it's so funny because like we were told emphatically that like high fat diets and cholesterol were the primary driver of cardiovascular disease. And it was just this year, like British Society of Diabetologists. They like finally, they're like, you know, if you're type 2 diabetic, a low carb diet is probably the best way to manage that. And I mean, it's 50 fucking years and how many tens of millions of people dead, you know, fighting this battle where type two diabetes is a complex disease, but really at the end of the day, it's a process of being shitty at dealing with carbohydrate, with dealing with glucose. But yet their recommended diet has been a 60% carbohydrate diet forever. And finally, these folks have just been beat down by the abject failure of this thing to say, well, it actually looks like it's safe from cardiovascular disease. It actually seems to put type 2 diabetes into remission, at least on a symptomology basis. So when people talk about like, you know, follow the science and stuff like that, you have to be really careful with that.
That's a pretty buzzwordy.
It's a complex
thing.
Topic. Yeah.
But I mean, two things can be true, right? Fact, the way that we're doing our farming right now is awful, but it's not necessarily the animal's fault. It could be that these big corporations just want to every single year, they just have to keep making more and more money. You know, you can have kind of both those things.
Absolutely. And just to dangle this out there, one of the main challenges of like the meat production side, and one of the reasons that it is so broken, is that there's a monopoly on processing, on slaughter and butchering and processing. And it is shockingly difficult to get like a slaughter facility up and going, and to get all the FDA anointing and whatnot. And part of that is that you want that to be a well-run process. You don't want that to be a slapdash process. But it's also clearly become this political monopolized thing. Like the big players will actually buy the time at these processing facilities at key parts of the year. They won't even put animals in there. But what it does is it makes it impossible for the local people to get access to the processing. So hunters and other people who have, you know, maybe they run 20 or 30 head of cattle and they want to get something processed and their local outfit is booked out. Oftentimes it's booked out, but empty, because the big processors will just buy that time, so that the small time operators are like, well, I don't even want to do this anymore. And then they get acquired by the JBMs or, you know, the whatever the big players are. So Senator Tom Massey put out this thing a couple of years ago called the Prime Act, which is trying to make it easier to have state level and county level oversight of slaughter and processing. And like, there's crazy things, or there are places that, you know, like they're supposed to have a 3 1/8 inch drain pipe in the floor for, you know, cleaning this stuff. And it's a 2.78 inch thing. So it's like, nope, you can't go. And it's like, oh, give me a break. Like every other thing is on point. You know, it's ridiculous stuff, but this would allow for more localized slaughter and processing. And this is really, you know, it's kind of knuckle dragger stuff. Like people don't get excited about it, but if you fixed this, then animals potentially are driving 5 miles for slaughter and processing instead of 1,500 miles for slaughter and processing. And if something goes wrong at one of these facilities, you know, like we saw this during COVID, like the workers got sick.
Smithfield plant?
Yeah, like the Smithfield deal. Yeah, like a huge chunk of the country's food infrastructure was kind of jammed up because of that one thing. So it sounds crazy, but these, it's kind of like if you're an army and you want a choke point of a pass, you know, they've created this choke point at slaughter and processing. So this is one of, like, do you want the animals treated better? Do you want more food access? Do you want more transparency? And I'll just throw this out there, like with not Bitcoin specifically, but like blockchain and whatnot, there are ways that we could track an animal from birth to death through the whole process using blockchain. So you know exactly what its handling and story was. And it would make it completely transparent as to what has transpired with the animal. Whereas right now, you don't know what the hell has happened with any of this meat. And like any given piece of hamburger that we eat right now can have up to 600 different animals' protein mixed into it. And if you had one mistake in butchering that animal and it gets some feces in it, this is where like you get these E. coli breakouts and everything, versus if you have a small operation, you can set it up so that like the package of hamburger you get is from one animal. And if that's contaminated, that's one thing. And again, using blockchain methodology, you could isolate it to that, know exactly where it came from, who was working at that time, do a retro analysis of what was happening, and then fix that process. Like we have these amazing tools at hand that we could just dramatically improve the quality of our food, the system. Whether you eat meat or not, nobody should feel good about like an animal being treated poorly and having a shitty existence before we get the benefit of eating it. But you could dramatically improve this stuff. And so
this is
the snowball into hell that I've been working on, because I don't know how I'll ever get paid for any of this, because there's nobody like just. You know, I mean, diet books are hard enough to sell.
If anyone
like,
can figure
cow.
It out, it's you, bud.
Yeah. But, you know, at a point in my career where I can kind of do some of this elective stuff, and I feel like it's my legacy play to just get people understanding that there are other alternatives out there. And it's not just gloom and doom. It's not the end of the world, whether we're talking about climate change or food security or any of this stuff. The main thing that will fuck things up from this point is if we hamper economic progress and technological progress, but also understand that we need to work more closely with the natural world. Like this is the funny thing, like all the Silicon Valley tech people think that the idea of like meat in a lab is a good idea, but these guys have never spent a moment on a goddamn farm.
Right.
So that's the only reason why it makes sense to them, you know?
Yeah, I think one of the projects out there is, I think it's VeChain, that is one of those mm-hmm. blockchain projects that I think is pretty interesting. Is there anything else you want to that you'd like to hit on?
Other than the greatest joy that I've ever had in my career, and I've been able to do some cool stuff, but is working with police, military, and fire. And it's the cool thing is that you all oftentimes, not everybody, but oftentimes take your fitness and your health as seriously as a professional athlete. And God bless, you know, folks in professional athletics, like it's really cool, but adults getting paid huge amounts of money to play kids' games is sometimes kind of ass-chapping to me and not really that interesting. And as a group of people to work with, I've never found them that interesting. Whereas working with police, military, and fire, like, I always love it. Always love the group of people, always love the commitment and the fact that your fitness is determinant as to saving your life, saving other people's lives. Like, they're, it really matters then. Whereas, like, somebody who's a stud athlete, and, you know, it's cool if I can keep them in their career maybe another couple of years and they make some more money and everything like that. That is super, super legit. No, not taking anything away from that. But, you know, our first responders have the toughest jobs in the world. You know, they just do. And so whenever I get a chance to serve this community, like, I just love it. Like, it is absolute treat for me. So it's an honor being able to chat with you guys. And if you want me to come back and bring down property values again, I'd be honored to do it.
Thanks, Rob. I appreciate it. Yeah. You should know that after, I mean, every day we're using Element, but, it's cool. We're starting to add it to our rehab. So, in come out of a fire, you go and kind of dump your gear, cool down, and we're using your salts to make sure that we can get back into action faster. So thank you.
That's cool. I mean, it, the one good thing about athletic environments and looking at this for insight, it is a more controlled environment, you know, so there is something that's interesting about that. And I'll say one of the biggest things that we see out of athletes is if they get on point with their electrolytes, their heart rate variability score, their recovery score dramatically improves. So I think what y'all are doing is spot on. And I mean, you can't start stacking up that recovery soon enough. And particularly because you don't know when the next gig is. Right. Like, an athlete knows, oh, I've got a game in 2 days or 2 hours or whatever, but you guys don't know when the next bell rings, you know? So being hyper focused on that recovery is huge. And it that's smart in my